Sorry, I'm running a little late. I was talking to some folks here at the beginning of the time. Several folks I've been able to touch base with, some folks I haven't seen in a couple weeks being out, and some guests with us as well. So it's good to have everybody here today. We're going to open right up into our lesson this morning, into Hosea chapter 4. Hosea chapter 4. If you didn't get a handout on the way in, though, we want you all to be on the same page with us. And raise your hand if you didn't get one, so we all have the notes and the scripture as well. Anybody at all? Anybody at all? All right, very good. We got everybody. Good job, Brother Paul. Best as always. All right, we're going to be in Hosea chapter 4. I'm hoping to be a little shorter today. We're starting a little late, so maybe we'll be on time. But we're finishing up last week's lesson. I attempted to try to finish two chapters, but I didn't really anticipate that I would, but I did my best. And we're going to finish that up this week. In the book of Hosea, Hosea is the first of the 12 minor prophets. And so it not only, the opening illustration of the book not only opens the stage for the book as a whole, but it opens the setting for all 12 of the minor prophets. And it does so with a vivid illustration of Hosea, a man of God who is faithful and who is good, being told to marry an unfaithful woman who, after he marries her, continues to remain unfaithful. And this whole illustration is to serve, and it tells us it's supposed to serve, as a visual for the relationship that God has with the people of Israel. Israel is scandalously immoral, and they have become scandalously destitute, but God has scandalously chosen to covenant with them and be faithful to them, regardless of the fact that they don't deserve it. And so even though we think the relationship between Hosea and this unfaithful woman, Gomer, is a scandalous thing, that's the point. That's how much God has chosen to love us in spite of the fact that we don't deserve it. And so that is all sort. It's vivid and concrete and easy to wrap our minds around. But for the rest of the book, Hosea 4 through 14 is going to serve as an explanation of in what way are the people of Israel being unfaithful. So they've been kind of vague about that in chapters 1 through 3. They're sinful. They're immoral. But how? We have to be careful when we do that to ourselves, and we need to just do better. Well, in what ways and in what areas? How does tomorrow look differently? And so what he does in the next couple chapters, really for the rest of the book, is he begins to describe to the people of Israel what the accusations really are. In what ways have they become the unfaithful wife of their faithful God? And so what we see in each one of these points, and I gave them to you again from last week, is we see him illustrating the things that they're doing, but he ties it together with their relationship. And we have to remind ourselves that it's not just the right or the wrong thing to do, it's the fact that we are building a relationship with God or tearing it down. There's a right and a wrong way to be a spouse, but not only is it good or bad, it's also smart or not smart if you want to have a good relationship. You're either building a relationship with another person or you're tearing it down. And you might be doing the wrong thing, but you can't just say it's only right or wrong. It's good or best for your relationship. And so what we see in each one of these, I gave two parts. So number one, I'll just mention them quickly. Number one, through disobedience, they chose not to know God. Here he outlines the things that they were doing. And some of them were just the Ten Commandments they were breaking. And he says, therefore, there is no knowledge of God in the land. You have no mercy, you have no truth, you have no hesed, you have no emet, you have no faithfulness and integrity, you have no loving kindness and goodness towards people. Therefore, there is no knowledge of God. You don't choose to know and dwell on the things that I am, you don't know me. So it's not just wrong for them to disobey the commandments. It was also that their continual decision to disobey God's character was a continual decision to distance themselves from who God was. Likewise, it is with your relationships. It's not just the wrong thing not to try to dwell on the interests of your spouse. We just have to recognize that, therefore, we're choosing to distance ourselves from them by not living the same life together. And that's what the children of Israel are doing with God. That's what we do with God when we do the same thing. Number two, so through disobedience, they chose not to know God. Number two, through lust, they had chosen not to love God. They had chosen to eat up sin, it says, to fill their lives with the wrong things, as opposed to filling their hearts with the love of God. He says, that wine and new wine and whoredom had taken away their heart. And so once again, he talks about the right and wrong thing to do, but he talks about loving God or not loving God, and that's what it boils down to. Through lust, they had chosen not to love God. Number three, and this is where we stopped, through idolatry, they have chosen not to be faithful to God. It wasn't just wrong to worship other gods. I mean, that was commandment one and two, right? Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make any other graven image. It's not just wrong, it's unfaithful. They're either going to have God as their God and their one and only, or they were going to run around on the hills and the high places with their other lovers, which is how the Bible describes it, these other gods they're choosing to love. And likewise it is with us. So we're going to continue on. That was last week, and as we finish up these last couple points. Now, you might notice, if you were super observant, I did add a point, so I didn't resist the temptation to add a little bit this week. I apologize, but I did add a point because I felt like one point just seemed too short, you know? So I have two this morning. But I didn't extend the scripture any. I kind of parsed out that last point just a little bit more. Number four, through stubbornness, they have fallen back from their spiritual potential. Through stubbornness, they had fallen back from their spiritual potential. You know, I don't think any people in here actually start out as good spouses. You know, you counsel people. I've only done a little bit of this, but I've done some premarital counseling with two different couples. And the one thing you notice is you kind of want to just look at them and say, you're just going to have to do it and then come talk to me later. You know, none of us actually know how to be good spouses until you are for a while. And I don't think really anybody starts out well. They just learn to find out how bad they really are and they adjust. Or not. Right? I think what marks a good spouse to a bad spouse is not that somebody walks into it knowing exactly how to be a good spouse. I think you don't even really register how selfish you are until you marry another human being. We all think we're the most unselfish people in the world. Everybody else is selfish except for us. And then you start living with somebody and you're like, wow, I'm a jerk. And you don't realize it until you have to live with somebody else. I think what marks a good spouse to a bad spouse is somebody who's willing to adjust as they see their deficiencies, as opposed to the one who remains, no, I was fine. I know a lot of people, they start out in about as good of a place as they can be to be a good husband. That's as good as you're going to get, man, until you actually, you know, start doing life together. A lot of people start well, but then they don't continue well because they don't choose to actually grow. No, but this is the way I am. And then they dig their heels in instead of learning to cope with the fact that they haven't actually learned to be unselfish, really. Instead of learning to recognize that other people are more important than them in everyday life, instead of learning to adjust their likes and their dislikes in order to live life with somebody else. And so the people of Israel didn't really start out great. They didn't start out great. I mean, that's what the Bible even says to them. God tells them, I chose you, not because you were righteous, but because they're not righteous, and so I'm going to let you take over their land. I chose you, not because you were a great people, he says, but because I was going to have mercy on you. He tells them they didn't start out great, but they had plenty of potential. It wasn't that they couldn't move forward. They had to recognize who they were and obey. They had to recognize who they were and repent. They had to take God's instruction and apply it. The Christian life is not a privileged sport where you start out with extra benefits and therefore you're likely to succeed. It is a process of obedience and submission as you go along. You have to learn and then you have to apply. I mean, the thing is, God puts people into our life, and that's certainly true. God helps us understand things ahead of time, but nobody starts out great. That's how the Bible describes us. We are all gone out of the way. We're together become unprofitable. Our throats are open sepulchers. With our mouths we've used deceit. That's how we all start. But we all have the potential to be like Christ and be conformed to his image. It's just how stubborn we are that determines what the outcome is. See, the people of Israel, they had a lot of spiritual potential. Now, I'm going to bring up something here, and we'll see it here in just a second, so I'll bring it up now. This whole message is written to the people of Israel. We do have to recognize something, and this is going to come out in the next two points here. that at this time in Israel, they are split into two. This is very relevant for our next 2 points. The people of Israel had a, not really, they didn't really have a civil war. They were about to go to war, and they just didn't. They split. And 10 tribes went to the northern, stayed in the northern tribes together, and they became one independent nation with their own kings. And then the southern two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, stayed together. The northern 10 tribes are now called Israel, usually. They have more of Israel. The southern two tribes are called Judah, after the bigger tribe. But there's a little bit more behind that. See, Judah is one of the 12 sons of Jacob, and one of the prophecies that God had given to Jacob was that a ruler was going to come out of Judah, that one day the king would be there. And so Judah wasn't just big, Judah wasn't just strong, although it was, but there was this underlying assumption from the people, the king will reign from Judah. So for the southern two tribes to be called Judah made a lot of sense. One thing we forget is that there was a little bit of a underlying assumption of what my family is going to be in the northern tribes as well. When you turn to the book of Genesis, nobody would have thought Judah was the one coming out on top. The only story we have of Judah is when he like slept with his son's concubine or something, and then he has a son, Perez, out of that, and that's the guy who shows up in all these genealogies. Do you know Perez? So if you were to read through Genesis, you don't come out of Genesis thinking Judah's going to be special. Do you know who you're going to think is going to be special coming out of the book of Genesis? You're going to think that Joseph is going to be special, right? You finish reading the whole book of Genesis, and then you get to the story of Joseph, you're thinking he's going to be in charge. Well, Joseph actually gets the right of the firstborn. He gets two tribes instead of just one. There is no tribe of Joseph. There's the tribe of Manasseh and Ephraim. For a long time, Ephraim, he was given the right of the firstborn out of the two sons of Joseph as well. The tribe of Ephraim believed they were going to be extra special. And they really could have been. Joshua, for example, is an Ephraimite. Other leaders, Jeroboam, the first king of Israel, is an Ephraimite. And so they were thinking, we're going to be the new Judah, right? We'll take the throne. And so for that reason, the reason I tell you that is sometimes, almost in an endearing way, the prophets will refer to the northern tribes not as Israel, but as Ephraim. And the sad part of that is, I had to tell you all that because you didn't know. Because Ephraim didn't turn out well, but they could have. When you finish Genesis, that's what you expect. The tribe of Ephraim, Joseph's son, the one that Jacob blessed. You expect that to be the one. God refers to Israel as Ephraim. It's almost like an indication of what they could have been, but they weren't. And he refers to them this way here in Hosea. So let's look down on it. Let's look down on it. Verse number 15 of Hosea 4. Though thou, Israel, play the harlot, yet let not Judah offend. And come ye not unto Gilgal, neither go you up to Bethaven, nor swear the Lord liveth. So there's a lot here. Israel and Judah. He's been talking to Israel this whole time, the northern tribes of Israel, 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 Israel. And he says, so you're getting off the path. You don't have to. But I pray that it doesn't affect Judah below you. He points out two cities, Gilgal and Bethaven. It's possible when he talks about Bethaven, he's talking about Bethel. It's a little bit disputed about what he's talking about. But both of those places have a great history. Gilgal is the place where Joshua set up camp as soon as he passed the Jordan River. And he set up a memorial. It's the place where the manna ceased because God was going to feed them from the land. It was the place where they had Passover for the first time in 40 years. Gilgal was a very special place of remembrance before they moved in to conquer the land. If Bethaven is talking about Bethel, of course, that has a great history as well. Bethel was the place where Jacob saw the ladder, you know, and he names it the house of God. This is the place where God is. But as you trace the history of both Gilgal and Bethel, they cease to see their potential. Gilgal becomes a place, even in the book of Judges, that's filled with idolatry. And idols are standing in the land instead of the pile of stones to remember who God is. Bethel, we find out when Jeroboam I becomes king, he puts up a temple to worship a false god. So these places that were supposed to belong to God have corrupted themselves. Ephraim, that was supposed to belong to God, has corrupted themselves. They have chosen not to be what their potential was. I'll give you a verse in Amos, just as a side note. It's no wonder that Amos actually tells the people not to go to Bethel and not to go to Gilgal, which is a shame, because those should be places that were holy, but they had taken their potential and they had distorted it. He says, don't say the Lord liveth. I'm sorry. By the way, our fellows are coming by. If you can take your attendance slip, just make sure your name's on it. We can see who's in Sunday school this morning. Just drop it in the plate when it goes around. He tells them not to say the Lord liveth. It's not that you don't want God to live. It's more like a way you would swear by God's name. People who were just doing it for business or doing it for personal sake, to just use God's name for their own benefit instead of actually meaning it legitimately. But whatever it is, all these little notes here, you see what they could have been, and then you see what they're not. Look in verse number 16. So how does he describe them? He says, Israel slideth back as a backsliding heifer. Heifer, a stubborn cow that refuses to be led. So instead of following God's lead, they pull against God's leadership. Imagine, you know, God's people, the land that God's supposed to be, Zion, the Bible calls it sometimes, is now being called a backsliding cow. Like that's the picture he chooses to paint them. The cow that doesn't want to be led back to the barn. It's very similar to how Jeremiah calls the people the donkey that's looking for a mate in the time of her heat. It uses derogatory terms because of what they had truly become. They, instead of being God's people and priests, they had chosen to become beasts. Now let's look as the verse moves on. Instead of being this, now the Lord will feed them as a lamb in a large place. In verse 16, the insinuation of the Hebrew here is that God would like to lead them like lambs, but he can't lead them like lambs because they're acting like stubborn cows. See the distinction there. Verse 17, Ephraim is joined to idols. Let him alone. That's a very sad thing. Leave him alone. In the book of James, it says that when the rich, they're self-reliant and they oppress other people, and it says the Lord doth not resist you. At some point in time, the number of times you resist God, at some point in time, he's just going to let you do what you want. And that's like a very dangerous place to be. Ephraim, he says, leave them alone. Their drink is sour. They have committed whoredom continually. Their drink is sour. They had turned to alcohol, and their alcohol ran out, or it went bad, and so they turned to sex instead. That's what that phrase means. Their drink is sour, so they commit whoredom. Her rulers with shame do love. And so because of their whoredoms, because of their immorality, they continue to go after that love to their own shame. It says this, give ye, meaning they continue to ask for more. They love in the wrong way continually, and they continue to ask for more of it, which is a very typical response from people who are trying to fill their hearts and lives with sin instead of filling it with the love of God. The wind hath bound her up, verse 19, bound her up in her wings, and they shall be ashamed because of their sacrifices. They will be taken up in a whirlwind. This is a picture the prophets often use of the people when they're gone away into destruction, almost being taken up in the wind, blown away like chaff. And they will be ashamed because of their sacrifices. It's difficult to know whether or not they mean they're trying to sacrifice idols religiously to appease God, because that's a normal thing the prophets talk about, or they're sacrificing to other idols. Either way, it's not appropriate, whatever they're doing, because they're not doing out of love for God, and so therefore it is to their shame instead. None of these things should Gilgal or Bethel or Ephraim should have been. But here he shows us the picture of why they are that, because they've chosen to be a stubborn cow. They've chosen to pull against God's leadership. We don't have to turn out the way that we're going. But when we're stubborn, we refuse to be led. Then we refuse to grow. In Christmas Carol, the Christmas Carol, I read it a couple years ago. It's that Charles Dickens writes it very, very well. But it's the classic story of, you know, Ebenezer Scrooge, right? And he's visited by four ghosts, Jacob Marley, and the ghosts of Christmas past and present and future. And when he's visited by the ghost of Christmas future, he sees his funeral. He sees his deathbed, people happy that he's gone, taking all of his stuff. I don't know how familiar you are with the story. But Ebenezer Scrooge falls on the ground and asks the ghost of Christmas future this question. He says, are these the things that will be, or are these the things that may be? Because a man can change his ways and see a different fate, he says. And what's interesting is the ghost doesn't reply to him, because the ghost of Christmas future notoriously answers zero of his questions. He just, like, creepily points at things. And so the readers sit there to wondering, are these the things that will be, or are these the things that might be? Because isn't it true that a man can change his ways? And that's why the end of the story is so happy, because Ebenezer Scrooge goes down and he buys the duck for the family with Tiny Tim, or whatever the bird is. I guess it would be the goose. But anyway, you see that he can change his ways. In sci-fi movies now, there's all this talk about multiverses and these different stories being played out in different scenarios. And I think one of the interests of those is it causes the people to think about this situation. If things were a little different, and if I made a slightly different decision, what could things have been otherwise? And that's why those stories are so interesting to everybody, because we wonder, I'm not destined for this path. And if I had made this decision instead, things could have turned out a lot differently. I mean, the first multiverse movie there was It's a Wonderful Life, right? You know, George Bailey, if I had never been born, what would life have been? And the rest of the movie explores what it would have been if things had been different. And here, it's sad to think, what could Israel have been? But that's not what they are. I mean, what did God want them to be? I gave you a verse, Exodus 19. He says, this is what I want you to be. Ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. I want you to be an easy, a holy, and a direct line for the rest of the world to see who I am. That's what I want you to be. I want you to be a nation that's set apart to me. That's what I want you to be. That is what they could be. That is not what they were. And by the way, that's the same terminology the Bible uses about you and me. In 1 Peter chapter 2, it says, ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that ye should show forth the praises of him who's called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light, which in time past were not a people, but are now the people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. And so how is it that we can see that potential play out for us? Peter's not writing to Israel. Peter's writing to Christians. We're supposed to be the people that are set apart to God so that the whole world around us has a direct access to who God is. We're supposed to be the ones pointing people to him. But we're not going to be, verse 11, if we don't follow the path. Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lust which war against the soul. Why are those two things together? Because as we become closer and closer to our love for the world, we become less and less a holy nation, a peculiar people, and a chosen generation, and a royal priesthood. What we could have been, we have ceased to be because we have chosen to be stubborn. We could have been acting like God's family. We could have been being the place of the remembrance of God, like Gilgal. We could have been the house of God, like Bethel. We could have been priests of God. But in our stubbornness, we refuse to listen. We refuse to grow. We refuse to see our potential. That's what Israel was. And it's sad to read it, because that's not what they were supposed to be. So that's number four. Number five. That was actually the new point, just so you know. This was the old point. Number five, through continual failure, they have negatively influenced those around them. Through continual failure, they have negatively influenced those around them. So part of the important picture that we're seeing here that it's easy to miss, I had to point out for the sake of this last point specifically. You have Israel, Ephraim, people that could have seen God's blessing because he wanted to bless them. And then you have Judah in the south. Go back and look at verse 15 again. Though thou, Israel, play the harlot, yet let not Judah offend. Hosea says, you know, Israel, if you're going to throw your life away, I hope it doesn't affect and bleed down into Judah below you. We're very comfortable telling people to stay away from other people. Like, make sure you pick the right friends. Don't marry that kind of person. Don't go to that kind of church. Don't get counsel from that kind of person. Don't go into business with that kind of person. But we always have to recognize that whenever we give somebody that counsel, we're making ourselves accountable to be that. Because wouldn't it be a shame if somebody else said to us, don't be friends with that guy. Don't marry that kind of person. Don't go into business with that kind of person. Don't be friends with them. We don't want to be on the receiving end of that, but we all recognize the good counsel of it, don't we? There's not every single person should be your best friend. Not every single person should be the person you marry. Not every single person you should go into business with, which means some people are choosing not to see that. And see, Ephraim, Israel, had chosen not to be what they could have been. And Hosea, who appears to be standing near the border, and we're going to see it in a second, between Israel and Judah, is looking down into Judah and saying, I hope that they don't receive this bad influence. So then we're wondering now, having read that verse, if they do. Let's look at chapter 5. We're going to go through chapter 5 pretty quickly. Hear ye this, O priests, and hearken ye, house of Israel. Give ye ear, O house of the king. Judgment is toward you, because ye have been a snare on Mizpah, and a net spread upon Tabor. They've been a snare. They had caused them to trip up and to get trapped in the sins that they had been doing. Both Mizpah and Tabor, and some of the other cities we're going to see in a minute, that they just sort of label a lot of cities, all these cities are very close to the border between Israel and Judah. So it's almost like you see Israel's wickedness bleeding down into Judah or not. But that's what he's standing looking at these cities that are nearby Israel's influence and hoping it doesn't spread into them. But it says they've been a snare to Mizpah and a snare into Tabor. Verse 2, the revolters are profound to make slaughter, though I've been a rebuker of them all. They're continuing to live in bloodshed of various kinds, whether it's the violence of war or the violence of killing their babies like they would the altar of Molech. They'd been filled with bloodshed, though God had rebuked them through prophets and through judgment. Verse 3, I know Ephraim. Israel is not hid from me. Kind of like in Revelation where he says to every church, I know your works. I see what you're doing. God's not blind to what's going on in our life. O Ephraim, for now, O Ephraim, thou committest whoredom, and Israel is defiled. They will not frame their doings to turn unto their God, for the spirit of whoredoms is in the midst of them, and they have not known the Lord. Back to chapter 4, there is no knowledge of God in the land. It's very interesting phraseology, though. They didn't frame their doings to turn unto their God. You frame your life one way or the other. You structure it. You schedule it. You have certain things that are landmarks in your life, things you do or things you don't do, things that you purposely prioritize, things that you set to the wayside. You frame your life, and you either frame your life to turn to the things that you want, or you frame your life to turn to God with your schedule, with your time, with your money, with your energy, with your priorities. They had not framed their life, their doings, to turn to God. And that's what Israel had done. So this is none of these verses are a surprise. So what of Judah? What of the people nearby? Verse 5. The pride of Israel doth testify to, as you just have to say, look at their life, right? Their own pride testified to their face. Therefore shall Israel and Ephraim fall in their iniquity. Look at the end. Judah also shall fall with them. Just last chapter, I hope Judah doesn't fall. Well, they did. And we know that. As time continues on, they have some good kings, they have some bad kings, but Judah ends up following the same path. Judah will fall with them. They shall go with their flocks, with their herds to seek the Lord, but they shall not find him. He hath withdrawn himself from them. A lot of times people will do perfunctory religious things in order to get God's favor. Fix my problem, God, and having pushed him away, we don't just get to say, I'm going to live as I please, and then God, you have to fix all the consequences for it. And that's what they were doing here. Judah falls with them, and they both see destruction in their life. Look, verse 7. They have dealt treacherously against the Lord. They have begotten strange children. Now shall a month devour them with their portions. The strange children picture goes all the way back to chapter 1. Hosea marries the immoral woman. They have children that they name scandalous things, like not loved, not my people, the place of violence. And it's a picture of they had chosen to live this way, therefore what they produced was also bad. And so here he uses the same picture. Israel has produced the wrong things. And as a result, they're not provided for. A month devours their portions. There's some different disputes about what it means by that. It could be as simple as saying that everything that they have goes away quickly. A month is not a long time. It could mean a certain ritual for a new moon that they were celebrating for a false god. But regardless, they didn't have their needs met because of the way that they lived. And so he warns all these cities right here on the border, some in Israel, some in Judah. Verse 8, blow ye the cornet in Gibeah, the trumpet in Ramah, cry aloud at Bethaven, after thee, O Benjamin. All these places right there in Judah. Ephraim shall be desolate in the day of rebuke. Among the tribes of Israel have I made known that which shall surely be. He tells them to tell all these cities right across the border in Judah, pay attention. Ephraim is not doing well. Israel's not going down the right path. It's not going to work out for them. Don't follow suit. Don't follow the same path. But he still insinuates in that they're going to anyway. And it's so sad to watch people. It's like, don't follow the same path. And then they do. And you watch as their life crumbles, regardless of how often you blow the trumpet to tell them to listen. They choose not to. He's warning them of what they're choosing to bring upon themselves. Verse 10, the princes of Judah, which is sad. We were talking about Ephraim, Israel, Israel, Israel. But the princes of Judah were like them that removed the bound, like a landmark, a line, a border. They cross over the line. They don't care about the boundaries in their life. That could be literal. Remove not the landmark. Don't steal your neighbor's land. And it could be figurative. They're crossing over the boundaries that God had laid for them. And probably both. Therefore, I will pour out my wrath upon them like water. Ephraim, the north, is oppressed and broken in judgment because he willingly walked after the commandment. It's good to walk after God's commandment. Most people believe he's talking about man's commandment. They willingly walked after what other people told them to do. We see that in the book of Jeremiah, the Rechabites. God's been telling all the people to obey his word. He points to this group of people, the Rechabites, who their ancestor told them not to build a house, not to plant a vineyard. And so they refused to do it no matter what the circumstances. And Jeremiah says, great, more power to you, but my people won't obey my words. You'll take your words seriously of the people behind you, the men behind you, and that's fine. Then take my words seriously. And so they willingly followed after commandment. Here's the thing. We often find ourselves prioritizing what people think over what God thinks. And this is what Israel had done. And therefore, it wasn't going to go well for them. Verse 12. Therefore will I be unto Ephraim as a moth. Moth that they... In the Bible specifically, they use it as a picture of things that begin to deteriorate. Moths eat up your clothes. He says, he will be to Ephraim as a moth and to the house of Judah as rottenness. And it's very sad. You see this whole picture. Ephraim, but also Judah. I hope it doesn't bleed into those around them. But you know, it always does. It always does. A choice not to follow the Lord is not only a choice not to have your needs met, it's a choice not to find satisfaction where satisfaction really comes. But we also must recognize this. A choice not to follow the Lord is a choice to influence those around us to do the same. And that's what this whole picture shows us. Really easy to read over unless we know just a tiny bit of geography. But once we see what he's saying, he's lamenting the fact that Ephraim's bad decisions are now affecting Judah's bad decisions. People are watching you. You are not an island. Your decisions affect those beyond you. Pastor Meyer was just talking about this yesterday. He was talking about leading children to the Lord. And he was saying there's a lot of obstacles in giving kids the gospel. Some of them are cognitive. They don't have big vocabulary. They can't understand abstract things. And so we have to be careful. Kids are used to not understanding a lot of what adults say and just nodding in response and repeating words back to them in order to get through life. So you have to acknowledge that. But he also pointed this out. Sometimes reaching kids is difficult because their ideas of spiritual truths are distorted by what parents and adults have poured into them. He gave two examples. He said there's a lot of parents who don't give love freely. They communicate to their children they must earn love. And therefore, telling kids God loves you unconditionally and the gospel and salvation is a free gift that's to be received and not paid for is very difficult for them to literally understand. Not just that they don't believe you, it's they don't have any context for that. Because their parents' sins have influenced their actions and their thinking. Or the flip side might be true. The parents who never tell their kids that they're wrong and always go to their rescue to the teacher, and it's always the teacher's fault or the other kid's fault, and never my kids, communicates to the kids, you don't have any faults. So the first part of the gospel, God loves you, or the first part of the gospel, we're all sinners, they don't understand. Because the bad teaching of their parents or the adults in their life has bled into their thinking. Now, the kids aren't going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ and God's going to say, go to heaven anyway. Your parents were bad parents, so, you know, it'll all come out in the wash. Go ahead. That's not what's going to happen. But I will say this. Adults will stand before the judgment seat of Christ for how they have poured into those around them. And whether it's your kids or whether it's your spouse or whether it's the people in the ministry to which you belong, your life, Ephraim, and all that you can be, bleeds into the Judahs nearby you who are watching. And it's a sad commentary on our own life by how much we pour into those around us when they don't go the right way either. We have to recognize that these decisions we're making are not just about us. They're about those who are watching us. And so the controversy he has with them is that they're not just destroying themselves, they're destroying people nearby them. So think, who in your life is watching you? Who in your life are you responsible to lead? Who in your life maybe you're not responsible for, but your decisions will affect theirs? We have to recognize our choice to follow God is going to bleed into theirs. Now, I want us to stop there because I was going to read the rest of our passage right now, but it's actually a setup for next week, so we're going to leave it alone at that. So now they're in this bad state. Where will they turn? Who should they go to for help? Usually, as is their way in Israel and Judah, they don't go to the right spot. But God always welcomes them back. And so we're going to see that next week as we open up chapter 6. So let's pray this morning, and we'll ask for God's hand and blessing in the rest of our time here. We'll have a couple quick prayer requests.